have a little time for some
Sure.
Q&A.
Sure.
David has a question.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to thank you for a marvelous talk. I say this is the best talk on spiritual warfare that I've had in my 40 years of ministry. To say that I hope that the members of my congregation, I haven't ever said it the way you've said it, but these are the things I stand for in the congregation. Your balance between the individual and the corporate nature is wonderful. I would add one other thing, and that is that I've always gone to churches which have had some kind of trouble before I came. I think it's fair to say that we've been through some kind of trouble. I hope that that trouble has decreased when I've been there in ministry at that time. But I believe your principles for building an effective congregation or army of God in the midst of the warfare, these are the principles I want to bring to bear. I'd add one more, because I think what you've done as well is stimulate other ways in which this warfare can go on. I think that chaos is a weapon of the enemy, and that good order, but not so much that it stifles creativity, is also a huge, of huge importance. And once again, for those who know me, I think you know that I've tried to bring and try to bring to the church good order, not to stifle things, but to make sure that communication then can flow. So in the middle of the battle, good communication all the way between those on the front, those in the back. Those things are huge too. So you, not only I think you've given us food for thought, me food for thought, but what I hope I would do in any sermon, that is, allow that thinking to keep on spreading into different areas, so that we do think of life in many realms in these terms. So this is a heartfelt thank you.
If you don't mind, I'll add to this in a different way, just because it's popped into my mind. Divide and conquer is always a winning strategy. Whether it's physical or spiritual warfare, divide and conquer always wins. I personally believe that Satan has achieved an enormous tactical victory when he got the New Testament published separate from the Old Testament. When I was a new believer at the Naval Academy, I was given a New Testament, and the upper class, the guys that were discipling, said, you don't need the Old Testament. We're under grace. We're not under law. You need the New Testament, Psalms, maybe Proverbs, but you don't need it. So it was jettisoned. It's taken me a long time to recognize that's bad theology. And so what I've learned in this is that when we divide the scriptures, we create a false Jesus. Because Jesus on the road to Emmaus said to those men, beginning at the law and the prophets, and explained everything concerning himself. So Jesus is as much a part of the law as he is the gospels, as much a part of the prophets as he is the epistles. He's the Jesus of the scriptures, not just the New Testament, or not just the Gospels, or not just the Sermon on the Mount. The other thing we do, we divide ourselves from one of the great sources of belief. If you remember the story of the rich man and Lazarus, and the rich man's in the bosom of Abraham, and he's talking to the rich man now who's in hell, and he says, send him to my brothers. And he said, no, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. And then he says, well, no, if someone rises from the dead, then they'll believe. And Abraham says, no, if they don't believe Moses and the prophets, they won't believe if somebody rises from the dead. Now, men, who rose from the dead?
Jesus.
Moses and the prophets is essential to an accurate, correct belief in Jesus. And the other thing that dividing that does, it cuts us off from the promises. 1 Peter 4 says, the precious and magnificent promises, in order that you might partake in the divine nature, come from basically the Old Testament. So we need to bring the message of the scriptures, the Jesus of the scriptures, not just one section of the Bible. So divide and conquer, there is an application. This kind of things I see because I'm looking at this through these lenses of warfare. So David, you're the pastor. I don't know if you've ever heard that before or not, but we've got to get back to his book, his manual. And it's the whole thing. It's not just part of it.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
What would you say to someone who finds themselves in the midst of chaos where people are panicking? And what would you say, what would you recommend to someone who sees this to convey to the other person that he is being divided and Satan is trying to conquer? How do you bring somebody down to earth when they're in a panic and feeling that, feeling divided, but they don't know it?
That's a hard question to answer. I'd really want to have some time to think about it, probably know more about the circumstances. Probably in that midst, I think you're just going to have to wrestle with them. Just get close, stay with them, keep talking, keep engaging. Prior to that, I would say one of the big issues, perhaps the biggest issue, is learning to have a couple of other people in your life where you're doing it together. Jesus sent his guys out two by two. I can't find, you know, this. We talk about man-to-man, one-on-one type stuff. That's a navigator deal. I can't find that in the scriptures. The only place I find Jesus dealing with one person, one-on-one, is the woman at the well. And the only reason we know that is it says the disciples are in town buying chow. Everything else that Jesus did it with a band of brothers. It was Peter, James, and John. He took them to the Mount of Transfiguration, the healing of Jairus' daughter, into the garden. He didn't function one-on-one. So I would encourage to get a little group, just two by two, and work together. And in this case, going and meeting with this person, talking to him, trying to reason with him, I'd do that with two or three with you. I wouldn't try to do that by yourself.
John, as far as late, that was a full breakfast, brother. I think it'd be good for you to say a word about the thing you're doing with Bob Shore and everything, about it. Just a matter of prayer for these men, because they're looking for prayer.
Some of you may know the name Robert Schuller from the Crystal Cathedral. This is his son. Robert's a wonderful brother, really focused on Jesus, and he's gotten engaged with some guys who are really sincerely, deeply committed to trying to bring reconciliation between North and South Korea. And so they're above ground and behind the scenes working to help resolve that situation, not just because of the current dialogue or current whatever between their president and our president, it's about the people and the heart that they have for the people and the suffering in the North that is there. So there's a movement and a really sincere effort to try to bring healing and reconciliation. And is it going to happen? We don't know, but they're working on it, and this is the kind of thing they need prayer for sure. But it's active, it's real, and it's right now a lot of us below the radar.
In the last week, Ken Burns has put his thing on Vietnam on PBS. I don't know if any of you have seen it. I lived through that time. And there are a lot of aspects that I didn't even know were going on at the time I was living through that in college and whatever. And you said you returned there recently in 2007. And I was just wondering, since they were our enemies, so to speak, and you went back, did you get the chance to interact with any of these folks? And what did the healing happen in all those years? That's 40 years ago. That's a long time.
You know, folks, when I went there in 2007, went from the Delta to Hanoi, went the whole length of the country, went twice, went over to the Cambodian border, the Laotian border, to places where we had been during the war. And it was just a couple of days that I was there, I began to sense there's something here that's different. The people are happy, prosperous, vibrant. They're out on their motorcycles, and it was an incredible difference. And I went to a friend who, Van Vong, who his family left there in 75 when he was like 6 years old. He had a little small business over there, and I had dinner with him. I said, Van, what in the world? This doesn't click. This is a communist country, but these are happy people. And he said, look, John, he said, there was 35 million people in this country when the war ended. Today there's 85 million. Way over half the population has no connection to the war whatsoever. And he said, our government is a communist government, yes, but they're a capitalist government. He said, as long as I take care of my employees, run my business, make a profit, you couldn't ask for a better relationship with your government. Now, if I go out there and start holding little signs, human rights or civil rights, they'll be all over me. but they're a business-oriented. So when I traveled around, I only saw the police, I only saw anything that would look communistic with some of the, they had the hammer and sickle on some of the flagpoles, you know, flags waving like we have our flags. The only other time I saw them was when they were directing traffic and they were unarmed, or when they were running a speed trap. Only time I saw police, anything that even looked like police. Never saw the military. But I had another experience. When we went over to, I can't remember where it was, but it was the beginning of the Ho Chi Minh Trail coming into South Vietnam, when they were coming around through the DMZ and coming into the south, building this supply dump west of Hue in anticipation of the Tet Offensive. Folks, I can't even begin to describe the ruggedness of that terrain. It was rocky, it was steep, it was just absolutely, just hard to describe. And I'm standing there and I'm in this and I'm thinking, here were guys who would strap 3 81-millimeter mortar rounds on their backs, trot from Hanoi to this supply dump in flip-flops, unload those 3 mortar rounds and trot and get 3 more. And I stood there and I thought, you know what? We completely misread this war. We completely misread it. We are not going to ever beat that kind of spirit. And I thought, you know, that's kind of probably what it was like in our country in 1776. What Ho Chi Minh was after was he loved his country and he wanted to unify it. He wasn't a communist. The domino theory that I'd been taught was bogus. I came away, and in fact, the group that I was with, there were 13 Naval Academy, 11 Marines, including a retired 4-star, and 2 Swift Boat guys. And we all concluded that was a war that should never have been fought. And I'm going to give you my personal take. When I give tours to the Academy, and any of you want to come over, I'm more than happy to do it. I always take the tour to our museum, because in the museum is a diorama of Admiral Nimitz signing the surrender documents from the Emperor of Japan aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay in August 1945. And I tell folks, I believe that history will ultimately record it at that moment in time was the beginning of the decline of Western civilization. And the reason I believe that is in that point in time in August 1945, this country was the world's power. We weren't one of the world powers. We were the world power. We had the nuclear bomb. The Russians didn't get it until 48. Our factories were unscathed. Our whole system was just so overwhelmingly superior to everything else in the world. And I believe at that moment, the seeds of arrogance were sown. And so over the years, those seeds, we've been harvesting them. And I think Vietnam is one of those areas that where we harvested them, because all of my general officers were World War II veterans. Al Davis was a Medal of Honor winner. Lew Wilson was a Medal of Honor winner. Lew Walt had 3 Navy crosses. They all fought in World War II, and they came out of a World War II view of war. Power, air power, bombing, all of that kind of stuff, and they simply didn't have the capacity to retool themselves and realize this was not what we were fighting. It was a completely different war, and we didn't adjust. We didn't deal with it the way it should have been dealt with, and if we had, we wouldn't have gone to war. So that's kind of what I came out of it.
I'd like to just add something to that, John. I worked at a company in Australia for 4 years named Telstra, and we rebuilt the telecommunications system in Vietnam after the war was over. So I went up there several times during my 4 years in Sydney. And one time I was sitting with a woman who was a civic leader in Hanoi, and she was about 45 years old. And I said, and she said to me, she said, "What's been your biggest surprise about being in Vietnam over the past several years, off and on?" I said, "My biggest surprise is real quick because it's at the top of my head. My biggest surprise is how interested the Vietnamese people are in the United States and how friendly they are to somebody when they find out you're from an American." I said, "I don't understand that." And she looked at me and tilted her head, kind of RCA dog look, and she said, "Why should we be angry at the Americans?" She said, "You know, The Chinese have been trying to take us over for 1,000 years. The French tried to take us over for 200 years. You guys were here for 10 years and we beat you. Don't be angry about it.
Yeah, when we were there, our time ended in Hanoi, and we went to the Marine House, which is where all the Marines live, who are the embassy guards and stuff. And a couple things that I learned. Our first ambassador to Vietnam was a POW who had been in the Hanoi Hilton. So that, I thought that was interesting. But the thing that was most interesting to me, he said, now this is 2007, he said the most sought after social ticket to the social event, the most sought after invitation in Hanoi was the Marine Corps birthday ball on November 10th. Oh, that was pretty cool.
General Schwarzkopf, he was describing his Vietnam experience, said, and I think it was a traumatic time for him. He said, I will laugh again, but I will never have that easy laugh again. And or that full belly laugh that he knew when we were young. And I just wondered, as a Christian, for yourself, how was it for you?
Well, I came out of I came to Jesus when I was in the military, and my discipleship, so to speak, was with the Officers Christian Fellowship, which is a marvelous ministry within the Officer Corps of the Armed Forces. And so the idea of war and killing and being involved in that, we had a pretty clear vision that this was part of our calling as a follower of Jesus, as a soldier, or in my case as a Marine, in our military, in our government, that this was permitted, was okay. I still believe that. I do believe that evil has to be dealt with. Now, that how we define evil becomes problematic. I don't believe we defined it correctly when we got to Vietnam. ISIS, my son's in the Special Forces down in Fort Bragg right now. We just lost 4 SF guys over in Niger. The stuff that's going on there is evil. It is about as evil as it gets. And in those cases, I would have no problem engaging them in active combat. So I prefer to fight evil with good, and sometimes good is an M16. If you go back to the Holocaust, we tend to forget this. The armies, the Third Army and the 101st Airborne and some of those that liberated those death camps, they were angels in uniforms. As far as those prisoners, those people were concerned. So we can't say either or when it comes to this issue of war. Thank you.